Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine, the 1 o'clock hour. Good afternoon. I'm Ed Kieser, along with Dave Leake, coordinator of the Starkel Planetarium at Parkland College, and we're doing our edition, our third edition of Sky Guys. We'll be talking about weather and astronomy, and if you have any questions this afternoon, you can call in. The numbers are 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. And before we get started, I want to thank our producer, Harriet Williamson, our technical director, Jason Croft, and Henry Frayne in Master Control for making all of this possible. And Dave, good to be back with you here on Sky Guys.
Hey, it's good to see you. It's been a while.
It has been a few months here, and I know a lot has been going on both weather-wise and astronomy-wise, and we'll talk about that as we go through the next 50 minutes, but hopefully we will get questions from the audience. And again, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. I guess one place we can start is we just had a shuttle mission come to a successful completion with a local astronaut, Joe Tanner, making his fourth trip into space. Anything noteworthy from that mission that you'd like to talk about?
Besides the fact they lost a few bolts?
Besides they lost...
Yeah. No, really, the thing that's interesting is after a long hiatus where we finally took a mission up to continue construction on the International Space Station. The last one was up in about 2002. And then, of course, we had the Columbia accident when it returned back to the Earth. But 15 more shuttle flights to go, and hopefully we'll have the construction completed by 2010.
And Joe Tanner, of course, was a featured speaker, what, about 9 years ago now at the planetarium. I remember going to see him speak, and from all accounts, this was his final mission to space. He's had quite a distinguished career.
Yeah, it might be. Again, his fourth flight, and he holds, and I can't remember if it's the duration or actual number of spacewalks, but he's number two on the list, so that's a pretty big accomplishment. And he was here for our 10th anniversary, and the 20th is next year, fall 2007. So what do you think? Should we have him back?
I think so. I think you should invite him back.
Well, he was a good speaker the first time.
And, of course, he's had a lot more to learn and new things to talk about here over the last, it will be 10 years next year. Let's see. The other thing I wanted to just ask you about, as far as the planetarium, of course, you have new shows. The World of Science lecture series is starting up soon. It's on the first Friday of every month, and I believe you have a weather topic for the first World of Science lecture this year.
That's right. In fact, I'm very happy with our lecture series this academic year, and we start off on October 6th. Dr. Michael Schlesinger from the Department of Atmospheric Sciences will be at the planetarium at 7 o'clock to talk about human-induced climate change. And very anxious to meet him. I hear he's a very dynamic speaker, and he's going to have a lot of neat things to say. The big topic, as you well know, I mean, even Al Gore has a movie, right?
That's correct. One thing I can say is I believe that he is one scientist that's actually had over the last decade and a half or so a change of opinion as new data has come in. So I think that makes it more interesting. He isn't somebody that's just been on one side or the other on this whole debate. His opinions have been dynamic as the science has brought in more data and more information, and truly being a scientist rather than just being swayed by popular opinion there. So that should be an interesting program. Who else do you have in the series?
Coming up, Parkland's own Rich Blazer will be here on November 3rd to talk about evolution and intelligent design, which ought to be really interesting. That's been a big issue as of late. And we're very happy to welcome back Dr. James B. Kaler in the U of I Astronomy Department on December 1st to talk about touching the sky, how the cosmos interacts directly with the Earth. And it's so much like the Earth is not separated from the cosmos. We are a part of it in different ways that we actually interact with it. That should be really interesting. We're looking forward to that.
Well, it sounds like a good lineup indeed. And of course, if you have any weather questions or any astronomy questions, this is your chance to ask any questions dealing with the sky on this edition of Sky Guys. I'm meteorologist Ed Kieser, along with astronomer Dave Leake, your astronomy and physics professor and coordinator of the Starkle Planetarium at Parkland College. Again, the number to call is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL or 1-800-222-9455. And we do have all lines still open. So
I'd like to mention something you're going to be involved in here. I believe, is it next Thursday? The Katrina Summit?
Yeah, day after tomorrow. There's a what's called the Katrina Summit going on, mostly on the U of I campus. It actually kicks off tomorrow night at the Virginia Theater between 6 and 9:30 p.m., and they're going to be having a kickoff to all of this at the Virginia Theater tomorrow evening, and there's going to be, I believe, University of Illinois's Roadside Conversations Airstream trailer, and will enable everyone to record personal Katrina stories. That'll be outside. And there will be spoken word performances and hip-hop from Prime Meridian. And that's tomorrow night at from 6 to 9:30 at the Virginia Theater. And then there are a bunch of programs going on for several days after that. I'll be the moderator of a panel called Inside the Digital Storm, Using Computers to Understand and Predict Dangerous Weather. And that will be in the NCSA Auditorium. The NCSA building's a brand new one just across Goodwin Avenue from WILL. That will be between 1 and 2 p.m. And we're going to have panelists not only here but in other locations. We're going to have Dan Reed, director of the Renaissance Computing Institute. That's in North Carolina. Also Ed Seidel, director of the Center for Computation and Technology at Louisiana State University, obviously LSU, well interested in Katrina. And we also are going to have Bob Wilhelmsen from right here at the U of I at NCSA, the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. So if you have any interest in anything Katrina, including how storms are forecast and the latest on the research, that's coming up Thursday. That particular panel I mentioned, 1 to 2 p.m. in the NCSA auditorium. It's free and open to the public.
Well, I was just about to ask if that's something that the public could come to. So it sounds pretty interesting.
Public can come to it. I think they like people to register, but it is free. And I think you can register on site. So just come on by and love to see you there. And, of course, last night the Superdome reopened. The Superdome being badly damaged by Katrina a little over a year ago, and the Saints won.
It was only fitting, right?
It was only fitting indeed, but a sign of at least something coming back to a little bit of normalcy in New Orleans, although it's going to be a long, long time before New Orleans is even close to being normal, because a lot of places were a lot more devastated in New Orleans from Katrina than the Superdome. As bad as the damage was in the Superdome, that area wasn't as hard hit as a lot of the areas that were completely inundated by water, and a lot of neighborhoods are still essentially wiped out.
It doesn't seem like we've had the hurricane activity this year, have we? Has it been?
No, so far only 7 named storms in the Atlantic Basin, and that's a lot less than last year. Mm-hmm. We ended up with 27 last year, which was a record, the old record being 21. So we're a little behind average, actually, now. But it still is hurricane season. The main reason for the decrease in number is a little bit more wind aloft, wind shear, which tears hurricane and tropical storm, well, tropical storms apart before they can become hurricanes or strong hurricanes. That's not to say there won't be any, but that's the main reason why this season's been quieter. Well, we have a couple of people now lined up on the telephone, so we're going to go to a listener from Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Could you give me the latest scientific information or data you have on global warming? There's all kinds of it all over the place. Could you give me what you have on that? I'd appreciate it. Thank you. I'll just hang up and listen.
Well, for some reason, I knew I was going to get that question, and I'll just say I am not a global warming expert, and Dave, I know that that's really not your area either. You kind of look at all the planets from afar. The evidence is clear that the Earth's warming, and I don't think there's any debate about that anymore. There is global warming, and I believe based on everything I read, and when it comes to this topic, because I'm more of a day-to-day weather forecaster, I just have to read like anyone else. More and more of the scientific data coming in is suggesting that human influence is a large part of the current warming scenario. And a lot of this is due to the increase in carbon in the atmosphere, mainly due to carbon dioxide, but there's also methane and other gases that are carbon-related that absorb radiation emitted by the Earth and send some of that radiation back toward Earth, and as a result, we have this warming effect. As far as the implications on what that will do to individual areas of the world, I think that's where there's the biggest debate. Well, there's a couple debates. How fast is the warming going to continue? Or is there going to be an increase in the rate of warming, or is it going to be steady? And different areas are going to be affected differently, and I think there's a lot of debate on that. But there's certainly concern and justifiable concern, and I think the World of Science lecture in the planetarium on October 6th would be a good one for anybody interested in this debate to attend. And by the way, the admission price, it's really expensive, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a whole dollar. We would do it for free, but we can't really do public shows for free. So it's just a buck at the door.
Well, we'll see what happens. Maybe we'll have Dr. Schlesinger on. I know he's been on WILL before. Maybe we'll have him on again at some point here to talk about global warming in more detail. I wish I could give you more definitive answers, but that's not my area of expertise. But I will say the Earth's general atmosphere is warming, and more evidence is pointing toward what many have suspected for a long time, that human influences are greatly the cause of that. There may be some natural cycles involved as well, but certainly it appears that there are influences. A great portion of the warming is due to the prolonged period of adding carbon to the atmosphere over since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And now we're just starting to really see some of the impacts. So thanks for your call. We'll move on to line two, and we'll take that call also from a listener in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is kind of lightweight compared to what you've been answering. I was wondering if the angle that rain falls into the small backyard rain gauges, does the angle affect that total?
Yes.
That's a good question.
And the answer is yes.
Because it seems it should vary as to the sign of the angle of it falling.
Well, unfortunately, there is no good way to make precise rainfall measurements in all situations. And basically, they'll get what's called an undercatch when there's a lot of wind. Usually, the rain gauge will not catch as much precipitation as if it's falling straight down, and that's just one of the problems we have in measuring rainfall. There are different types of rain gauges, and they have different strengths and weaknesses, and there's no ideal way to perfectly measure rainfall. So the best we can do is just measure it on a consistent basis from station to station and compare the data accordingly. But certainly that's a good observation. We do have usually underreads when it's very windy.
And you have multiple stations too, don't you, that you can compare to?
Yeah, we can. Now, here at WILL, we have one automated tipping bucket rain gauge up on a pole. And actually, when it got very windy, it would overread. And that's because the pole would start to shake the gauge, I think, and cause the tips. Every time so much rain would get on into the gauge, it would be by weight. When a hundredth of an inch worth of rain would get into the gauge, it would push this little tipper, sort of like a seesaw, and then that would record a click of 1/100th of an inch. So if you have that little seesaw mechanism in the rain gauge, being tipped by the wind knocking it around, that was giving an overread on that. So every rain gauge has its idiosyncrasies. Official rain measurements are taken with what we call an 8-inch rain gauge. That's an 8-inch diameter funnel that collects the rainfall.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
I hope that helps. And now we move on to a caller on our toll-free line, line 4, a caller from Mattoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My question is, I heard someplace that heavy sandstorms or storms of some kind were coming from Africa and had some effect on the Atlantic winds and turbulence there. I wonder if you have any comment.
I haven't heard. Not that it isn't happening, but I haven't heard anything about that.
Well, it was earlier in the year.
Well, there have been studies done on Saharan dust, and I know that sometimes can affect the weather patterns in the tropics, including near the Atlantic. And some may think, well, you're talking about Africa. Why the Atlantic Ocean? Doesn't the weather move west to east? Well, it does in the middle latitudes, but in the tropics, the weather does move east to west. So there have been some studies on dust coming off of the deserts, primarily of Africa, that would affect the Atlantic basin at times.
But, nothing this year, then, you've heard? I heard this someplace that there were real heavy sandstorms and that it might affect the number of hurricanes.
Well, I don't think that the hurricane number has been greatly affected by that. There could have been some heavy sandstorms earlier in the year coming off of Africa. That's certainly possible. But the primary reason why the hurricane numbers are down are due to a little bit stronger winds aloft. And actually, a developing El Nino over the Pacific Ocean may be helping to shift the winds aloft globally in the tropics just enough that it's cutting down on the number of hurricanes this year.
Is the temperature of the water in the Gulf different from what it was last year?
It's still very warm. I don't think it's quite as warm as it was yet last year, but it's still certainly warm enough to be a breeding ground for tropical storms and hurricanes. And, of course, you need sea surface temperatures to be above 80 degrees, really, to breed hurricanes and tropical storms. But the main limiting factor, the number one limiting factor this year, is what we call wind shear, and it's the fact that there are stronger winds aloft. When the winds are light aloft, those storms can just grow in size, just grow straight up, and you get the massive swirl of thunderstorms, which makes up the tropical system. And the strong winds aloft, that tears it apart, which is completely different than storms around here, where strong winds aloft aid in the development of storms. But in the tropics, strong winds aloft are not good for storm formation.
One more question. Does the El Niños in the Pacific give us a milder winter, or does it have any effect?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer is it depends on how strong the El Nino gets. The statistics I've seen over the years do correlate very well to a strong El Nino, meaning a mild winter with usually less than half the average snowfall. Now, we've had many mild winters with low snowfall in recent years, so you can get that even without an El Nino. I would not jump the gun on this particular El Nino because it's not yet strong, and signs at this point are it's not expected to become one of the really strong El Ninos, such as we had in 97-98. So with that in mind, there are other factors that could determine our weather. We've been persistently mild here over the last couple of decades, but that doesn't mean that we can't have a real strong, cold, snowy winter here sometime in the near future. So I think you'll see a lot of people forecasting a mild winter just because of El Nino. My caution, anybody that's listening to those forecasts the question asked is it a strong El Nino? If it's not a strong one, then all bets are off. Anything can happen.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your call.
I thought it was the woolly worms all this time.
I could get into the woolly worm, Conjure. The woolly worm forecast, have you? I don't know. Do you ever pay attention to those?
I had woolly worms all over my house. It's surprising you could see my house this summer.
It depends on the kind. It used to be the woolly worm forecast came out a little later than it does nowadays, and I read something last year where, for those that believe in the woolly worm forecast, you got to use the woolly bear caterpillar. And a lot of what's out in early and mid-September is a different caterpillar, not the official one. And those caterpillars that are out in early and mid-September are generally dark, which forecast a nasty winter. Those aren't the ones to use to forecast if you use woolly worms.
So you got to identify your caterpillars carefully.
You have to do that first before you can even make the forecast. And a lot of people are jumping the gun these days on the first ones they see. It's got to be the woolly bear.
Well, I had all different colors all over my house.
You'll probably have some warm days, some cold days, some snowy days, and some sunny days this winter. How's that?
A great mix. That's a good forecast.
Yeah, just like in the summer, chance of scattered thunderstorms and a high in the 80s. That usually does it most days. Well, anyway, our lines are open right now. You can give us a call if you have any questions, not only on weather, but astronomy, anything that may interest you in the sky. Dave Leake is here. He is the coordinator of the Starkel Planetarium at Parkland College, and I'm Ed Kieser, chief meteorologist here at WILL. And between the two of us, we can answer a lot of the sky questions. The number to call, well, there's actually two numbers. You can either call us locally at 333-9455, or toll-free at 222, or 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455 and 333-9455. And I just had a note shown to me and something I was going to bring up. You know, lately for me, the question I get is global warming. I bet you can guess what I'm going to ask you about.
Well, it's one of two things. You're either going to ask me, was Mars the size of a full moon this past month?
No, because I didn't see that. So what's the other question?
Is what's the deal with Pluto?
Yes. What's the deal with Pluto?
Guess what? It's still there.
That's the one thing. I heard some people say, talk about the demise of Pluto, and it's still there.
It's still there. It's doing very well. It's a little chilly, but it's doing very well. Our perceptions of it have changed a little bit, though, since here a few weeks ago, I guess we now have a new definition of planet. And they have kind of dropped Pluto from the ranks of classical planet, and now it's a dwarf planet, which has a lot of people upset, because wouldn't a dwarf planet still be a planet?
Well, yeah. And the other question I've got is, how do you get a chunk of rock that's an asteroid and make that a dwarf planet? And what is the definition of a dwarf planet? Is there just one asteroid big enough to qualify? Or?
Well, that one's pretty big, but it's still the size of the state of Texas.
Okay.
So, and that's the largest asteroid for all the Bruce Willis fans out there. You know, I think that was the size of the state of Texas, that one that he tackled in Armageddon. So not one like that out there.
So no Alaskan-sized asteroids.
No. So, yeah, it's been really interesting. The thing that I guess tickles me is that this is a great example of how, as you mentioned earlier, science is dynamic. It changes. And we get new information in, then our perceptions change about things. Now, this still won't make the kids happy. The kids are really upset that...
Are they? No, actually, that's a funny thing. Well, first off, in this whole debate, I'm not close to it, but the one argument that I thought was most ridiculous is you have to keep Pluto a planet or kids will be upset. That's not scientific. That has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, that's not a real good reason.
Yet I've heard from some grown-ups that their grandkids have talked about Pluto and understand all that's going on and have explained to their parents and grandparents what's going on. And I think kids are actually more fascinated by the planets, by this, I don't know if you call it controversy or whatever you want to call it, but they're more fascinated by this change in this dynamic situation we have in the science right now than they are just saying, oh, it was a planet, now it's not. I'm sure there's a few that are sad about it, but I think a lot of kids actually are jumping on this. It's mm-hmm. a good, maybe teachable moment for the solar system.
Well, with the advent of the internet, kids know a lot. They would come into the planetarium, and we'd talk about the nine planets at that time anyway, and they'd say, well, they found a 10th planet. And it's like, well, that's not official yet. But every group would say, well, yeah, there's 10 planets up there. Like, well, let's not jump the gun. I don't think the controversy, at least in the professional ranks, is really the fact that Pluto is not perceived as a planet anymore. We don't like to use the word demoted. It sounds real negative. But it's sort of how it happened. And, of course, I wasn't there at the meeting, so all I can do is report what I've read. But it was kind of an 11th-hour proposal, you know, right? In fact, it was over in Prague. So I heard about the latest proposal. It was almost like 11 o'clock at night here. And that's the one that got voted in. And you know how you've been to conferences, how a lot of people leave conferences early. From what I understand, only about 5% of the people who were at this conference were sticking around for this vote. It was something that kind of got put in right there at the end. So that's riled a lot of feathers. But here's the way I look at it, and I justify it this way. Given of all the stuff that we found out about the solar system and all the new discoveries, if Pluto had been discovered, say, in January, we probably wouldn't be calling it a planet today. So it's just historical.
And this takes nothing away from the discovery back in 1930. That was still quite a discovery.
A young man, a lot of the textbooks say a Kansas farm boy. He's from Streeter, Illinois.
So, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He grew up in Kansas, but he was born in Streeter, Illinois. The people in Streeter, from what I understand, are not real happy.
Well, Pluto is still Pluto, as you
That's
noted,
right.
and
it's
whether
there.
It's a classical planet, a dwarf planet, or a member of the Kuiper Belt, if you want to discuss what that is briefly, it's still there.
Yep. You could say that old Clyde Tombaugh discovered the first Kuiper Belt object back in 1930, so it's still a big accomplishment.
Excellent. Well, I see our phone lines are quiet at the moment. That happens sometimes when we have a beautiful day weather-wise. A lot of people taking advantage of this late summer weather. And right now on Friends Plaza, the temperature happens to be 75 degrees. So,
I heard something. Was there we have tornadic activity in southern Illinois recently?
Yeah. We really lucked out here on Friday. There were the ominous forecasts for tornadoes and severe storms, and some nasty storms went by to the north. Big trees knocked down around DeKalb. And in southern Illinois, a few tornadoes were reported, and apparently one near Murfreesboro was an F4. And that tornado... The event location was from approximately 3 miles southeast of Perryville, Missouri, to 2 miles north of Murfreesboro, Illinois, so across the Mississippi River. And the current estimates are the peak wind reached 210 miles per hour, and it traveled 27.5 miles. So one of the longer track and more violent tornadoes in the month of September. There have been other F4s in the U.S. in September, but they're rather rare, and that's the first F4, I think, in Illinois since the Roanoke tornado in July of 04.
You know, the radar was strange on Friday, it seemed like, where it almost looked like you had a couple of, almost looked like railroad tracks, you know, a couple of bands of heavy storms, and right in the middle was... You know, Macon and Piatt and Champaign counties, and I don't think it even sprinkled here.
Well, our total rainfall for a couple of days was just a couple hundredths of an inch. And you mentioned the railroad tracks. Sometimes storms do what we call train. When training storms are one storm following the other, just like train cars. And when you get training, then you have problems with flooding. And there are some places in western Kentucky that picked up over a foot of rain.
Oh, my.
A lot of rain, a lot of flooding down that way. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. If you have any questions on the sky, and if you have a planet question, a moon question, a question about tornadoes or winter storms, anything of the like, that we can open it up to any kind of sky question you might have.
Anything from the Earth's surface on up.
I deal with the first 8 miles or so, and then Dave takes over, and Anything the clouds can block, he takes over. Yeah. I do the clouds on down here, and I see we have the phone lines are starting to blink here, so we will have some calls coming in a moment here. And again, we do have a couple lines open as well, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. And I guess we have a caller on line one. Go ahead.
Hi, Ed. I was just wondering if you could maybe talk about the, and this may not fit your program, but like forecasting for 30 days out or anything like that.
Okay, I can talk a little bit about forecasting for 30 days out, which the first thing I'll just say is I don't like doing it because it's not very accurate. And the only reason there are 30-day forecasts and forecasts beyond is because people say they want it.
Isn't there just too many variables?
There are too many variables. The atmosphere operates on many different time and space scales, and little phenomena can influence the big picture over time. So the farther out you go, the less accurate the forecast gets. So we can give a 30-day outlook. The only time that they're usually of any benefit or if there's any, that there's any maybe certainty is if there's a strong weather pattern that's in place or there's something such as a strong El Nino in the Pacific Ocean in winter, which will make a forecast for certain parts of the country rather easy when you trend it out. And the parts of the country that the forecast is easy for is generally the Gulf Coast.
There's a 100% chance of darkness tonight.
That's an astronomy forecast there. Excellent. But anyway, 30-day forecasts are not very reliable. Usually, forecasts are not good beyond about a week, and certainly 2 weeks is about the max. And as some know, even a forecast going out a day isn't always accurate, as the forecast for this past weekend was for ominous weather, and really we didn't get much rain right here. As you noted, south and north of here, yeah, there were those railroad tracks where a railroad track appearance on the radar with lots of rain. And that's part of the problem, too. When you start making forecasts for specific points, then it's really difficult when you look out 30 days. You could have the general trend right, but be wrong for a small area because there's a variability in the weather.
Right.
Exactly. Well, now we're going to go to line four, and that is a caller from Terre Haute. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a moon-related question. Last week, one morning, I was leaving for work. There was a beautiful crescent moon, but you could see the rest of the moon behind it, you know, the dark area of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the disk there, I think they call that Earthshine.
Yes.
Like that. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit. I know that you don't always see that with a crescent moon, and what kind of situation, you know, conditions have to be for that to happen. And
well,
I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. The light that you're seeing that's bouncing off the moon is coming from the Earth, actually, which is where Earthshine comes from. The light from the sun bouncing off the Earth, going up to the moon, and then being reflected backwards. And on something like a first quarter moon or a gibbous moon, I mean, technically you'd have that effect, but the rest of the moon's so bright you're not going to notice it. So you do notice it on the thin crescents. I imagine a lot of that would have to do with cloud cover, wouldn't you think? Because with clouds making the Earth more reflective.
Yeah, I think so. And also, obviously, for us to see it, the clearer the atmosphere at our location, the better.
It's beautiful, though. It's interesting. In fact, next few nights, you might want to check if Ed can get the clouds to go away. You might see a waxing crescent moon in the southwest and might see a little Earth shine then, too.
Sounds very good. And of course, you want to get out to where there's not too much light pollution. That's becoming harder and harder to find.
That's true. Don't get me started.
Yeah, I shouldn't say light pollution around Dave. Anyway, what I will say is we have a caller on line two from Charleston, so we'll go there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a question. If you guys could make a prediction on when you think East Central Illinois will receive its first frost.
Boy, I'm not going to touch that one.
Yeah, that's my area. Well, I don't think we're going to have a widespread killing frost for a little while yet. We do have a shot of cold air coming in for Friday morning, and places up north will be more prone to frost, far northern Illinois into Wisconsin. And because the air mass is going to be cold enough, there will be scattered frost in some of the normally colder spots as early as Friday morning. But after that, it looks like we warm up a bit again. And outside of that, I don't have any weather maps in here to go farther ahead.
So should we cover the plants Friday morning, you think?
I'll let you know Thursday night for sure. But I think most of us are safe still on in this immediate area Friday morning based on what I see right now. But that's the first chance. If you live in a dip in the terrain in an outlying area, a normally colder spot, you might want to cover the plants. But as we get closer, we'll get a little more precise on the forecast. But
so tune in Thursday, right?
Tune in Thursday for the latest. But right now, that appears to be the earliest threat date. And then it looks like as we go through the weekend, it does start to warm up a bit. I hope that
helps.
That
always sounds good.
I guess he's gone. Okay. Well, we have about 8 minutes or so. So if you still have a question about the sky, either weather-wise or astronomy-wise or somewhere in between, give us a call. Our numbers are 333-9455, or you can call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. I'm Chief Meteorologist Ed Kieser from WILL, and along with me is Dave Leek. He's the coordinator of the Starkel Planetarium at Parkland College. And
if you're out looking for that moon here in the next few days, the brightest star-like thing in the southwest is going to be Jupiter. But if you want to catch Jupiter really with just the eye, the rest of this month and into the, well, over half of October, good time to see it. Then it gets going to get tough. It's really not a good fall for planets.
Well, I guess you go through these periods. Sometimes you see several of them really close together, and other times you don't see much at all.
From our point of view, they just are not, I don't want to say in line with the sun. They're not lining up, but they're in the same area, which makes them tough to see. So Jupiter is really it, unless you have a telescope to look for Uranus and Neptune, and even Pluto's out there too, but we've already covered that.
Okay, well, we've got another call. We have a caller on line one on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Hi. We went trotting over to Terre Haute on Saturday to see the performance of, I think it was called Dreams of Heaven. I may not have the title exactly right, but it was Neil Conan from NPR and the Ensemble Galilee and images from the Hubble Space Telescope. And one person said that it was interesting seeing the images with in the morning, because she was interpreting the light as from some of the images as being morning light shining on the galaxies. That it was, and I said that we're not talking about our sun shining on these galaxies. They're huge things. There wasn't anything explaining what the images were as part of the performance, and they were gorgeous images. Can you tell me, do you happen to know offhand roughly how big something like the Horsehead Nebula is, the one that they show enlargements of it? They show it from quite some distance, and then they show enlargements of it.
Well, I'm sorry I missed that performance. That sounds exciting. I don't have right in front of me the dimensions of the Horsehead Nebula. I can tell you I know it's light years big, so trillions and trillions of miles. And you're right that those things that the Hubble's collecting, the only thing that's really going to be doing any reflecting are there's some gas clouds that reflect the light of stars and, of course, our own planets. But yeah, most of that stuff is actually glowing, actually emitting its own light. And the Hubble images, they may not have talked about them, but some of them are just so beautiful that just the idea of having them there. It may not have really discussed what they were, but if you go to, I believe it's Hubble site, Hubble and then SITE.org, you can actually do a search and come up with a lot of those. You can go through all the nebulas and just some really beautiful pictures that the Hubble is sending down.
One of the things that I found intriguing is that some of the nebulae, I'm not sure what the difference is between a nebula and a galaxy, unless there are galaxies within nebulae. Is this where stars and systems are forming? And they, and you saw these dark areas. It was as though dark gases were, it was almost as though gravity was pulling them down. It was definitely a vertical structure to these huge things. I'm just was wondering if you had any, does anybody have an explanation for why there seems to be this verticality as opposed to circularity?
Well,
on some of them?
There's lots of different kinds of nebula, and all of them are inside of galaxies. Our galaxy, if the whole universe is like a vast ocean, then galaxies are like the little islands, and it's like the nebula beyond the islands. And they also come they do different things. A lot of the gas clouds that you see that are kind of reddish as the glow from hydrogen, and those are mostly stellar birthplaces. In fact, you often see those associated with star clusters. Some of the nebula kind of look bluish because they are actually near enough to a hot blue star. They're actually reflecting the light from that star and can look bluish. And then there's others, as you just pointed out, that really aren't glowing at all, but they're blocking out the light from the stars behind. And so they appear as almost in silhouette, kind of dark clouds out there. As far as structures go, some nebula are they're called nebula because they're gas clouds in space, but they're the leftovers from when, say, a star roughly the size of our sun doesn't explode, but, well, what I like to say is sneezes and kicks off its outer layers. And so a lot of those you see are circular or really spherical would be a more accurate word. They're called planetary nebula, even though they don't have a lot to do with planets. So those would be more spherical. But the verticality. I don't know if there's anything in particular on that. I would have to have seen the picture, but there's a lot of different kinds of structures as stars form inside these clouds and actually start shining. Their radiation pressure kind of, it's almost like blowing a little hole in the nebula itself, and they're just gorgeous.
Yeah, I think the verticality was in the Horsehead Nebula. It was just amazing trying to comprehend the size and what the structures were. It was just truly gorgeous. It was a combination of poetry, Celtic music, and these images. And some there was a lot. Neil Cunningham wasn't always saying the poetry. Uh-huh. Sometimes he just sat back and listened to the music and with the rest of us. But it was really an interesting experience, interesting combination of sensations.
Sounds wonderful. I know here at times the Krennerts had the Kronos Quartet here with images, and that's truly beautiful too.
Well, thank you very much for your call. We only have a couple minutes left, and we have a question on line four. Go ahead.
Hello, Ed?
Yes.
Okay. Listen, I'm traveling through Terre Haute, but I live in St. Louis. And I was camping in Murfreesboro, Illinois, quite a while back, and a tornado came through. Sometime later, we were traveling through Illinois and stopped at the museum in Springfield. I saw part of a tree trunk there with a cord going right through it from a tornado went through Murfreesboro years earlier. And what I'm wondering is there certain areas that are just normally prone to have tornadoes track through because of the weather patterns?
Okay, I'll answer your question quickly. Thanks for your call. Basically, when you look at the U.S., there are certainly areas that are more tornado-prone than others. But when you get on a smaller scale, there isn't a bullseye on, say, Sadorus in Champaign County or Murfreesboro in southern Illinois. That happens to be some of the bigger communities close to where different tornado tracks maybe go through. And, of course, Murfreesboro was hit in March of 1925 with the Tri-State Tornado, the deadliest tornado on record here in the U.S. And now they just had another tornado in the Murfreesboro area on Friday. So they do get them every once in a while, but so do a lot of other locations in southern Illinois as well as other parts of the country. So, yes, there are favored areas when you look at the country as a whole, but I think certain tracts within counties are overplayed a bit, and that's perception in part due to just identifying a tornado with its closest town. And in some areas, there's a lot of wide-open landscape with very few towns. And, Dave, we're up to the end of our time.
Yeah, that went fast.
We're going to have to wrap it up. Sorry for anybody's question we didn't get to here, but we'll do this again sometime.
Yes, it'd be fun.
That's Dave Leake. He's coordinator of the Starkle Planetarium at Parkland College. I'm Chief Meteorologist Ed Kieser here at WILL. And again, our technical director, Jason Croft. We have Henry Frayne in Master Control. And our producer for today's show is Harriet Williamson.